You're listening to Campus Killings, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family,
DNA ID, Zodiac Speaking,
Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
and Citizen Detective. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Today's episode brings us to Riverside, California, where a young woman's murder might possibly be connected to a well-known serial killer. Sherry Josephine Bates was born on February 4, 1948, to parents Joseph and Irene. She had an older brother named Michael. The family lived in Riverside, California, about 60 miles east of LA, after moving from Omaha, Nebraska in 1959. Sherry Jo, as she was called, was kind of a rock star in high school. She attended local Ramona High and was homecoming princess her senior year of 1966. Sherry Jo was an honor student and a cheerleader. She cheered on the varsity squad all 4 years. She was popular and friendly with lots of different types of girls. Sherry Jo was also extremely pretty, petite with blonde hair and blue eyes, and she was musical as well. She loved to play the piano. However, not everything was perfect. Sherry Jo's mom, Irene, reportedly suffered from mental illness and did not live at home with the family. She lived in a local mental health care facility. She later died on July 4, 1969. Her death may have been a suicide, but it's not certain that that was the case. By the time Sherry Jo graduated from high school, her brother Michael had joined the Navy and moved out of the family home. And Sherry Jo and her father were the only ones left. They shared the home that Joseph, a machinist, owned at 4195 Via San Jose. They were very close, and they reportedly had a great relationship. Now, as an 18-year-old high school graduate in the fall of 1966, Sherry Jo's goal was to become a flight attendant. So she enrolled at Riverside City College to take classes and had a part-time job at the Riverside National Bank to pay for the lime green VW Beetle she had bought herself.
That's so cool.
I know. I thought that was pretty cool, too. I bought my first car, but it wasn't a cool car at all. For 2 years, Sherry Jo had been dating Dennis Highland, who had graduated from Ramona High a year or two before Sherry Jo. Dennis was a high school athlete. He was kind of the all-American boy. He and Sherry were, you know, that model couple. In fact, they recently had gotten engaged. Dennis was playing football at San Francisco State, and earlier in October 1966, Sherry Jo and Dennis's parents had gone up to visit him and attend one of his home games. So let's talk now about the day on which Sherry Jo was killed. It was Sunday, October 30th, 1966. Sherry Jo and her dad went to church that morning at St. Catherine of Alexandria Church, where they were regulars. They went to breakfast at Sandy's Restaurant, a local haunt, and then Joseph left town to spend the day at the beach. Sherry Jo planned to study for her classes. Now, sometime around 3:45, Sherry Jo called her friend Stephanie to ask her if she wanted to go to the RCC library with her. Stephanie said she couldn't, so Sherry Jo headed out alone. She left a note for her dad that read, "Dad, went to the RCC library." It's believed that she left for the library between approximately 4:30 and 5 o'clock p.m., and this was based on a neighbor who saw that green VW in the driveway of her home at 4:30. Joseph arrived home at 5 o'clock, so just a little while later, and found the note, so we know that she left sometime between those two times. Pretty clear timeline here. Joseph knew that his daughter was studious, and it was pretty much the most common thing in the world for her to go to the library, but when she was not home after 9 p.m. at night, Joseph began to be concerned.
Why was he concerned? So it seems kind of quick to be concerned for someone. Maybe she's out with friends.
I guess so. But she was, you know, pretty much home after. And then he knew that the library closed at 9 p.m. And she would have left him a note if she was going somewhere else.
Okay, so it was out of character. It was out of character for her.
It was out of character. But he didn't. You're right. He was worried, but he didn't like call the police right away. In fact, he waited up for her all night, but by 5:30 a.m. on Monday, and that was Halloween Day, he was frantic. And at that point, he called the Riverside police to report Sherry Jo missing. But unfortunately, Amy, Sherry Jo was found before the police even had time to look for her. Around 6:30 a.m., a Riverside City College grounds keeper named Cleophas Martin was driving his street sweeper along Terracina Drive. It's a main road in which RCC was situated on. When he approached an alley, he immediately saw a woman lying face down on a dirt driveway between two vacant houses owned by the school. He drove off, of course, to call the police. We know this is before the time of cell phones. And Officer Don Walters took one look and called in the homicide unit. The woman in the dirt was clearly dead, stab and slash marks marring her body and blood everywhere. So this was clearly a homicide case. Now, based on the papers located inside a tote bag found either in her car or near her body, there are reports saying both, just to be clear. She was soon identified as Sherry Jo Bates, whose father had reported her missing just an hour earlier.
How far was she? Sorry if you said this. How far was she from her home?
I don't know exactly how far, but it was a local school, so it couldn't have been more than a couple of miles.
Okay.
The coroner removed the body after the scene was photographed. We're going to skip ahead to the autopsy because information gleaned by the medical examiner would inform the trajectory of the investigation. The ME at that time, Dr. Renee Modlin, wasted no time commencing the procedure at 9:23 a.m. on October 31st. So they're moving pretty quickly here. So Sherry Jo had been stabbed 42 times. She had
This is personal.
Ah, well, it's vicious. We can say that. She had a gaping laceration to her thyroid cartilage. In other words, her throat was cut so deeply that she was almost decapitated. So extremely violent. The ME confirmed that the cause of death was hemorrhage and blood loss due to the laceration of the right carotid artery. Sherry Jo also sustained stab wounds to her face, back, and breasts. The weapon was very likely a knife, with a blade half an inch wide and 3.5 inches long. Sherry Jo also had a fresh laceration on her upper lip and abrasions on her face, hands, and forearms.
Megan, is it safe to say these are defensive wounds?
Yeah, they appear to be defensive wounds, sustained when she put up a valiant fight but failed struggle against her attacker. His skin was also found under her nails. Yeah, we can gather that she scratched. The ME concluded, this might surprise you, that Sherry Jo was not sexually assaulted, leaving the motive for this vicious attack unknown. He estimated that Sherry Jo had been dead between 9 and 12 hours, so this put her time of death at between 9 p.m. on October 30th and 12 a.m. on October 31st. However, Dr. Modlin also noted that the contents of Sherry Jo's stomach indicated that she had probably eaten a meal just 2 to 4 hours before her death.
Why is that important?
Yeah, it's important because it helps to establish a timeline. You know, it helps to establish the time of death, and it might help us to figure out, did she go somewhere? The ME collected some physical evidence that might help in identifying the killer. This is obviously in the days before DNA, but so it was done by hair sample matching, blood typing, and so on. Dr. Modlin found several short brown hairs on the base of Sherry Jo's right thumb that was suspected to have come from her assailant. One of the hairs was still attached to a tiny blob of scalp skin. The doctor concluded that the hair's owner was a Caucasian male. He collected these hairs and bagged them for the police. Okay, now let's return to the crime scene. Riverside Police Chief Lambert Kincaid put 6 detectives on the case full time. Police went over every inch of that alley in an effort to locate and retain any and all pieces of evidence. Blood patterns on the ground where the body had lain showed that Sherry Jo had struggled with her attacker right where she was found. So this kind of indicates that she was attacked in that alley between the two vacant houses. Dried blood drops on the ground that led away from the alley towards Terracina Drive indicated that the killer had probably fled the scene in that direction.
Now, did anyone see anything? Do we have any eyewitnesses?
This is a great question. Hold that thought, though. I knew you were going to ask that. But first, the weapon. They're talking about blood and this attack. So was the weapon found? Well, no. The police did not find a weapon in the alley or anywhere else. But they did find a man's Timex watch lying on the ground about 10 feet from Sherry Jo's body. The band, which fit a wrist with a circumference of 7 inches, was torn. And police concluded that Sherry Jo had likely ripped it from her attacker's arm in the struggle. I mean, this sounds like she really fought. The band was spattered with common white paint, which told them that the killer was possibly a handyman painter or something similar. You know, could have been that he also just painted his house, but they felt like this was some indication of his profession. Amazingly, even though the watch was a common Timex, investigators were able to determine that it had been purchased at a military base in England. Riverside was also home to several bases, including the large March Air Force Base. So this kind of seemed like a promising clue. And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
Were there other things found at the scene, or what else is the scene able to tell us?
Yeah, there was an impression in the dirt in the alley near the watch, which was determined to have been made from the heel of a man's boot. The waffle print was clear enough that the investigators could glean that the boot was made by B.F. Goodrich, likely in the size 8 to 10 range. This was fairly small, I guess, but the depth of the impression suggested that the man was on the hefty side. I always find this type of footprint analysis interesting.
Kind of sounds unscientific to me, maybe potentially junk science.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I don't think this is quite scientific. This is more observational at this point, especially in 1966. But it's interesting what it can tell you, right? You know, it could tell you a little bit maybe about size or, you know, again, weight. So I think it's a good observation that could help, especially when you have a potential suspect. But there was also a cigarette butt that was collected. No one knew, though, was this significant or was it just litter, right? They didn't know if this came from the actual suspect. Sherry Jo's beloved VW Beetle was found by the police parked in the lot on Terracina Drive in front of the library. Now, one report we read said that the driver's side door was partially open and the window down. Library books lay on the front seat, suggesting that Sherry Jo had indeed made it into the library and checked out some books and then returned to her car. But what happened after that?
It sounds like she was getting in her car and someone tried to talk to her and she opened the window to chat.
Well, let's see. You're right, Amy. The Beetle tells us the story. The car was unlocked and the keys in the ignition, but the car wouldn't start. So the car's distributor wire had been disconnected, which had clearly been done deliberately. For those of you who don't know, the engine compartment of VW Beetles is accessible even by persons who don't have keys. So anyone on the exterior of the vehicle could unlatch the compartment and unhook the distributor wire. And with that piece not connected, the car would not have started when Sherry Jo turned the key in the ignition. So what this told them was that someone had clearly sabotaged her. And she had, like you said, gotten in the car, tried to start it, maybe then rolled down the window. There were also greasy palm and fingerprints in the engine compartment that the police were able to lift. While this is a major piece of evidence, they couldn't connect them to anyone.
What year was this again?
This was 1966.
Okay. So, yeah, things would have been a little bit different if this tragedy happened today.
Oh, things would have been a lot different, I think, especially with already there's skin, there's hair, there's so much evidence. So the police set out to retrace Sherry Jo's movements to see if they could figure out what happened to her. The library was located on the 4800 block of Magnolia Street at Terracina Drive. So you had asked me about how far it was. The drive from Sherry Jo's house, I don't know exactly how many miles, but it would have taken her about 10 to 12 minutes or so, Remember that the car was in her driveway at 4:30 on Sunday evening, but was gone when Joseph returned home at 5 p.m. So now we have a gap in the timeline, though, because at about 5:30 p.m., Sherry Jo had called a coworker of hers named Donna to ask if she knew where Sherry Jo's term paper was. Sherry Jo told Donna she'd misplaced it, but Donna hadn't seen it. The two spent a few minutes chatting and then hung up. Donna didn't know where Sherry Jo was calling from, but the library didn't open until 6. So I guess it was not, you know, she was not calling from the library. Mm-mm. A few minutes after 6 p.m., another girlfriend of Sherry Jo's saw her driving on Magnolia in the direction of the RCC. She told police that she waved to Sherry Jo, but Sherry Jo hadn't waved back. Perhaps she didn't see her. So where was Sherry Jo during the time between when she left the house and when the friends saw her headed for the library? We really don't know. This is one of the mysteries of this case. The easiest explanation is that Sherry Jo went and got something to eat, explaining the food that Emmy found in her stomach. And if he was right that she had eaten within 2 to 4 hours of her death, she would have died sometime between 7:30 and 9:30 p.m. or maybe as late as 10 p.m. Now, remember, those library books were found in Sherry Jo's car, so the police knew she made it to the facility, but they also had some witnesses who verified this. So you asked about witnesses earlier. Around 6:10 to 6:15 p.m., a man in the Air Force saw Sherry Jo drive up an alley parallel to the library in her very distinctive VW. He told police that her car was closely followed by another vehicle, a bronze mid-1960s Oldsmobile. Of course, this could have been nothing. It was a public thoroughfare traffic in the area, so it could have been someone just following her too closely, or it could have been someone actually following her. At around the same time, four young men standing at a fence close to the parking lot where Sherry Jo parked saw her pull in. So it was before she entered the library. The men estimated the time to be around 6:13 p.m. She got out of her car and walked towards the library. It's not clear whether they noticed the car or they noticed her. Either way, the young men loitered on the fence for about an hour until 7:15, but they didn't recall seeing Sherry Jo again. The police found only one witness who recalled seeing Sherry Jo inside the library that evening, and this was a male student who knew her. He went inside right when it opened at 6 p.m., and a short time later, he noticed Sherry Jo sitting and writing in a blue spiral notebook. This was somewhat inconsistent with the friend who saw her driving at around 6:10, but was chalked up to one of them being slightly off about their times, because it wasn't a drastic difference. Now, here's the second hole in the timeline. No one specifically saw Sherry Jo exiting the library that night, so multiple friends of hers told police they never saw her there. This included one group of friends who was in the library from about 6:30 to 6:40 p.m. and another who was in the building from about 7:15 to 9 p.m. And that's when the library closed. Not one of them saw Sherry Jo. They did see the four guys hanging around the fence at 7:15, though. But the police just couldn't get this firm grasp on when Sherry Jo would have left the library and returned to her car with the books. However, and this is crucial, Amy, several of these friends reported that when they left the library at closing time, 9 o'clock, Sherry Jo's car was parked in the lot where it was located the next morning, and behind it was a distinctive vehicle that drew witnesses' attention. I'm not a car person, are you? I really wouldn't notice unless it was, you know, very distinctive.
Yep, I agree. Yeah. Or if there was something like at a place going on.
Right, okay. The car parked behind Sherry Jo's was a light-colored Tucker Torpedo. This car did not belong to any of the students leaving the library. Now, we have to point out that it's highly unlikely that this car actually was a Tucker Torpedo. Apparently, only 51 of these were manufactured in total before the company went belly up. Police suspected that the car seen by witnesses was actually a late 1940s to early 50s Studebaker, which shared many similar features with the Tucker and was much more common. Police issued a request for tips from the public about a late 40s to early 1950s light-colored Studebaker with oxidized paint, so they seemed to be pretty sure that that's what they were looking for. Okay, so the latest that Sherry Jo could have left the library was a few minutes after 9 p.m. We don't know for a fact that she was at the library that whole time and her friends had just possibly failed to see her. Maybe she was in a quiet alcove somewhere and didn't want to be interrupted. So The next entry in the timeline was 9:30 p.m. when a female student told police she was walking near the alleyway near Terracina Drive, you know, that road that ran alongside the library. She reportedly saw a man in the alley smoking a cigarette. They said a quick good evening and she walked on. Because of the poor lighting and shadows in the alley and the fact that it was dark, this witness could not describe the man she saw. Police suspected that this was the man who was the source of that cigarette butt they found. And the timing of his being in the alley was intriguing because it placed him there shortly after Sherry Jo would have left the library and found her car inoperable. The library closed at 9 p.m., and this part of the campus was largely deserted at this time on a Sunday night. But sometime between 10:15 and 10:45 p.m., a nearby resident heard a terrible scream coming from the area of the alley. It was not repeated. This witness also heard a car start up a few minutes later. A second person in the area also heard a scream sometime around 10:30 p.m. Now, these screams heard by neighbors don't really match up completely with the timeline because Sherry Jo would have left the library when it closed at 9.
Just out of curiosity, anyone call in these screams? Or are they like, in hindsight, oh yeah, I heard a scream, but nobody called 911?
No, people did not call 911. This makes me think of the bystander effect. Were you thinking of that as well? Or
Yep.
Right? Yep. I mean, people hear a scream. They might not know what it is. They think someone else might call, but no.
They don't want to get involved. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The screams were heard more than an hour after the library closed. But one thing to note is that daylight savings time clock adjustments happened that night, so it's possible that somehow these time estimates got confused with the time change. Police investigated this case around the clock. They tracked down all the witnesses and questioned 75 people, expending 133 man hours within the first 2 days. None of Sherry Jo's friends knew of anyone who wanted to harm her, bore a grudge, was a rejected suitor, or was a stalker. Despite the holes in the timeline, the working police theory became that Sherry Jo's car had been disabled by her attacker, who waited for her to leave the library. He then likely offered to help her with her engine. Either this man was someone Sherry Jo trusted, or he somehow got close enough to pull a knife and coerce her, and then walked into the alley where they couldn't be seen from Terracina Drive passersby. Whether his motive was sexual assault is unknown, but Sherry Jo fought back, likely more than he expected, and he stabbed her to silence her screams. The sheer number of stab wounds indicates rage or passion, but the relationship between the killer and Sherry Jo remained a mystery. Meanwhile, Sherry Jo's funeral took place at St. Catherine's Catholic Church on November 4th. Detectives were in attendance, as they always are, photographing the crowd of 250 people in hopes that the killer was in attendance. Her poor father, Amy, collapsed from grief, stress, or both. Sherry Jo was buried in a Riverside cemetery, but her family had her exhumed years later so her ashes could be scattered at sea. They were even possibly tired of her gravesite being a tourist attraction because of her macabre unsolved murder. Police used a novel approach to try to make some headway in the investigation. On November 13th, 2 weeks after Sherry Jo's murder, they staged a reenactment of the night of the murder.
What do you mean they staged the scene? They followed her steps?
Yeah, this was an incredibly detailed effort, Amy, with 65 people who were at the library on the night of the murder taking part. The police even arranged for all those people to wear the same clothing they had worn that night, to sit in the same locations in the library, and to park in the same spots.
I haven't really heard of this. I guess this was an old case, but this isn't that common, is it?
I mean, I haven't really heard of that in this way. We know, like, people do reenact crime scenes to try to figure out, you know, bullet trajectories or things of that nature. But this was different. This is reenacting the entire day in the scene. I have to tell you, everyone who participated also gave hair and fingerprint samples. So that might have been part of this tactic. The endeavor was pretty well received and everyone cooperated and allowed police to learn that there was one man that was there on the night of the murder, but no one knew who he was and he didn't show up for this event, this reenactment.
So how do they know if no one knew who he was? How would they know that he was missing?
Well, because they knew they could identify him by seeing him, but they knew he wasn't there, but they didn't know his actual identity. They didn't know his name, if he was a student or anything of that nature. But the man was identified as a young, heavyset man with a beard. Cherry Joe's brutal murder received a lot of coverage in the press. It was a sensational story since the slaying of the, quote, pretty blonde co-ed was so horrific. You know, it was horrific. It was in a public place in a quiet, safe Riverside. And the newspaper stories included a lot of details. This was important because a confession letter would soon arrive containing details. So the police wouldn't have to sort out what information had been released and what hadn't. We'll return after a brief word from our sponsors. On November 29, 1966, almost a month to the day of Sherry's murder, both the Riverside PD Homicide Unit and the Riverside Press Enterprise newspaper received carbon copies of a typed letter, which was titled The Confession. I'm going to read parts of this letter, but we did leave some parts out that were very graphic and were just not necessary. It read as follows. She was young and beautiful, but now she is battered and dead. She is not the first, and she will not be the last. I lay awake nights thinking about my next victim. Maybe she will be the beautiful blonde that babysits near the little store and walks down the dark alley each evening about 7. Or maybe she'll be the shapely blue-eyed brunette that said no when I asked her for a date in high school. But maybe it will not be either. But I shall cut off her female parts and deposit them for the whole city to see. So don't make it too easy for me. Keep your sisters, daughters, and wives off the streets and alleys. Miss Bates was stupid. She went to the slaughter like a lamb. She did not put up a struggle, but I did. It was a ball. I first pulled the middle wire from the distributor. Then I waited for her in the library and followed her out after about 2 minutes. The battery must have been about dead by then. I then offered to help. She was then very willing to talk with me. I told her that my car was down the street and that I would give her a lift home. When we were away from the library walking, I said it was about time. She asked me, about time for what? I said it was about time for her to die. I grabbed her around the neck with my hand over her mouth and my other hand with a small knife at her throat. She went very willingly. But only one thing was on my mind, making her pay for the brush-offs that she had given me during the years prior. She died hard. She squirmed and shook as I choked her and her lips twitched. She let out a scream once and I kicked her head to shut her up. I plunged the knife into her and it broke. I then finished the job by cutting her throat. I am not sick. I am insane, but that will not stop the game. This letter should be published for all to read about it. It just might save that girl in the alley. But that's up to you. It will be on your conscience, not mine. Yes, I did make that call to you also. It was just a warning. Beware, I am stalking your girls now. Okay, and that was the letter. So apparently this letter appears to have some validity. A lot of the statements the writer makes mesh with the facts of the case. And Sherry Joe giving this guy the brush off could explain his pent-up anger and resentment. But also, Amy, the information the letter contained was available to the public. Anyone could have written that letter using information with the papers. Remember I said that they had printed every detail, every minute detail of the crime. It could have easily been a false confession. For example, the letter confesses, quote, I pulled the middle wire from the distributor. This sounds really specific, and the middle wire wasn't mentioned in the papers, but in 1960s cars, the middle wire was the only one that would have effectively rendered the entire distributor non-functional, so anyone who knew about cars would have known that. Mm-hmm. Police tried everything they could to identify the letter writer, but he went to great lengths to ensure that he was not found. He typed the letter on a Royal typewriter with Elite or Pika type. They determined that, but figuring this out was very laborious because he used carbon sheets to create copies and submitted the last pages so they would be the faintest. This made it all the harder to identify the type of typewriter used. The envelope was hand-addressed with big, bold, dotted I's, which were very distinctive, but the envelope bore no prints. The letter bore one, but it was never identified. Then in December 1966, a janitor at the Riverside College found a poem scratched into the underside of one of those wooden student desks in the RCC library. The desk had been turned upside down and stacked on top of an upright one for storage or cleaning, and this is how the janitor noticed the poem. It was only about 5.5 inches high in total, all in lowercase letters with the words stacked on top of each other. They said, quote, sick of living / unwilling to die. Cut clean. If red, clean. Blood spurting, dripping, spilling all over her new dress. Oh well, it was red anyway. Life draining into an uncertain death. She won't die this time. Someone'll find her. Just wait till next time. R.H. Now, there was no specific reference to Sherry Joe in this poem. She was not wearing a red dress when she was killed, and there was no way to tell when it had been written. It could have preceded her murder, and whoever wrote it would have no way to know that it would ever be found. It was on the underside of a desk. But the police were intrigued enough to document the poem and maybe consider who R.H. might stand for. So everyone with R.H. initials was considered, but they could never determine who the writer was. Meanwhile, Sherry Joe's case started to cool. An article in the Riverside Press Enterprise commemorated the 6-month anniversary of her murder, and it was followed by some more letters. On April 30th, 1967, on the 6-month anniversary of Sherry Joe's murder, 3 letters were mailed out postmarked in Riverside. They were sent to Joseph Bates, that was Sherry Joe's father, the Riverside Police, and the Press Enterprise. They read in childish all-caps scrawl on grade school-lined paper, quote, Bates had to die, there will be more. The one to Joseph just said she had to die instead of Bates. Police suspected that the handwriting in these letters was deliberately disguised so the writer could not be identified. So even though investigators had quite a bit to go on, they couldn't track down the letter writer, and they weren't making much headway in Sherry Joe's case. They doggedly considered to investigate every lead, but the case started to stagnate. However, there was one man that came to be the chief suspect in this case, but not in the eyes of the police. This was a man the RCC library staff and others at RCC believed had killed Sherry Joe. He was a library staff member, Ross Sullivan.
All right, so why do people think that?
It's interesting because it's not really clear why the other staff members suspected this 6'3", 300-pound Sullivan, other than the fact that he was considered weird. He did make comments about hurting or harming people. He talked about how he had escaped from a mental hospital. He always wore the same fatigues. He smelled of body odor, and he was generally considered creepy towards female students. The icing on the cake, I think, was that after Sherry Joe was killed, Sullivan went missing for about 6 days.
Yeah, that's a big indicator.
Yeah, I can see that. And when he came back, he also had cleaned himself up a lot. He also ended up moving away shortly after and was arrested for exposing himself to someone in 1968. According to Medium, he died at age 36 from heart failure brought on by extreme obesity. Library staff were so convinced he did it, though, that they had sent a letter to an investigative reporter laying out their theory and requesting that the reporter follow up because the police were ignoring their suspicions. Police had looked into Sullivan because of the library staff tips about him. He had been diagnosed with what was then termed schizophrenia, and Sullivan's brother had dated a close friend of Sherry Joe's. However, the cops said that Sullivan had a solid alibi. They've never revealed what it was, but they were able to discount him as a suspect. And I have to imagine it was a good one because they were looking very hard to find a suspect.
Yeah, I would trust law enforcement that if they were able to rule him out, I feel confident that he was not the guy.
Well, I do too. But the Riverside Police Department, they had developed a real suspect in Sherry Joe's murder that most of the investigators backed as her killer. This was a man who police believed did it, but could not prove it. He was never named publicly, but he was referred to as Bob Barnett by online sleuths. Police believe Sherry Joe had a romantic relationship of some sort with this man. Now, whether or not this was a real one or one that existed only from his perspective is not known.
Old was he?
I'm not sure how old he was. I don't believe he was of a significant age difference. But when she got engaged to Dennis, the police believe that Bob became enraged and killed her in a fit of jealousy. Reportedly, Sherry Joe and Bob had a public argument in which he hit Sherry Joe. Witnesses told the police that on the night of her murder, Bob had abruptly left a basketball game, referring to, quote, that bitch going to the library. This was not looking good. One of his friends reported to police that he had seen Bob on the night of the murder around 2:30 a.m., and Bob asked him for a ride to the library to look for something he lost in the alley. Another man reported that Bob told him in tears that he had killed Sherry Joe. Finally, Bob had moved out of the country after the murder and did not return for several years. Now, all of this sounds really promising, but when they actually tested Bob Burnett for his prints, DNA, and hair samples when he returned to the United States in the 1990s, none of them matched up to the evidence they had collected. But they did have DNA. Remember, they collected all the samples at Sherry Joe's autopsy, like the skin under her nails and those foreign hairs. They also retained the cigarette butt and the watch from the alley. None of that DNA, though, led to anyone in the databases they could find.
It's surprising that there were two people of interest that actually looked like they were potentially the offender, and they both were cleared.
Right. Through DNA. I mean, very powerful, right?
And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
Okay, we have to talk about one other potential suspect, one whom in the eyes of many certainly murdered Sherry Joe Bates. For others who have come to believe that he did not, it's still inarguable that this famous killer hinted that he had killed her and seemingly took some concepts from the confession letter. We are sure that all of you true crime podcast listeners are familiar with the Zodiac, a murderer who targeted mostly young couples in cars and taunted police with cryptic letters to the press bragging about his crimes. One reporter named Paul Avery at the San Francisco Chronicle covered the Zodiac case in the late 1960s at length. Then in November 1970, he got this letter from an anonymous writer. This is an excerpt from Zodiac by Robert Graysmith. Please forward the contents of this letter to the detective in charge of the Zodiac murder case. I hope this information will also help you, as we would like to see this case solved. As for myself, I wish to remain anonymous, and I know that you will understand why. A few years ago in Riverside, California, a young girl was murdered, just about, I believe, on Halloween evening. I could write a much longer letter citing the similarities between Zodiac's case and this murder, which occurred in Riverside. But if the police department cannot see said comparative similarities between these two cases, then I will take a slow boat to China, even if these two crimes were committed by two different people. I think that after all the facts are studied regarding both of these cases, if police have not already investigated these possibilities and are not already aware of the Riverside case, then even so, perhaps they should look into it. Letters to newspapers, similar erratic printing, find out about these two different cases. Give Captain Cross a call on the phone. He knows that I do not quit. Mr. Avery, I will give you a call in the near future. Please look into the case. The Riverside police have a wealth of information. So does San Francisco. Let us hope they are not too proud to work together. And if they already are, let us hope that there has been an exchange of information. Reporter Paul Avery was very invested in the Zodiac, who had sent him a Halloween card at the San Francisco Chronicle with the threat, "You are doomed." Avery followed up in this anonymous letter. It turned out that the letter writer was a Riverside man named Phil Sins, a local armchair detective. Avery contacted this Captain Cross in Riverside, who told him the name of the letter writer and said that Sins had been reaching out to police for years, suggesting that Zodiac and Sherry Joe's killer were one and the same. Captain Cross gave Avery access to some of the case materials, and this is when Avery saw the Z signature on two of the three crude handwritten letters sent 6 months after the first confession. Avery started to buy into the theory. He went to Riverside and reviewed more of the case materials, including that original confession letter. And this is when he noted some starting similarities between that letter and the Zodiac's writing starting in 1969. Now, it's crucial to note that Zodiac never specifically mentioned Sherry Joe Bates, but some of his missives contain the exact same misspellings and odd sentence structure as the confession letter.
It didn't fit his normal MO, right? Didn't he usually kill couples?
Usually couples. But let's look at these phrases. One is the phrase, "She squirmed and shook as I choked her and her lips twitched." Zodiac had written a July 26, 1970 letter to the San Francisco Chronicle, the famous letter that starts, "This is the Zodiac speaking," claiming 13 victims. The letter contained the phrase, "Some I shall tie over anthills and watch them scream and twitch and squirm." So I think that was, you know, a similarity. The thing also, Zodiac used the same words. He also misspelled twitch. So twitch was misspelled in both letters. But there was more. Both killers referred to their murderous game. Both commenced sentences with conjunctions like but and or. Both had mailed their letters with double postage. The three Bates had to die letters each bore two stamps. As a result, some believe that Sherry Jo Bates was Zodiac's first kill. Now, that might explain why she doesn't fit the typical MO.
Yeah.
Others believe he deliberately piggybacked on the confession letter, which was all out in the public domain, or that it could have just been a coincidence. But Paul Avery was convinced. He ensured that all the letters were sent to handwriting expert Sherwood Morrill, who was an expert on the Zodiac letters. The handwritten confession envelope with its big, bold eyes was certainly the same writer, Morrill believed. Morrill concluded that all letters were written by the same person. Sherwood Morrill has been quoted as saying that the Riverside writings were unquestionably the work of the Zodiac. Based on this expert assertion and his own hypothesis, Avery went to the press with this link in a series of articles in November 1970.
So how did this impact the case?
Well, it had a direct impact on the case, actually, spurring a collaborative meeting between the chief Zodiac investigators and the Riverside PD. The meeting lasted 9 hours and resulted in agreement that the Zodiac likely wrote the Sherry Jo letters and had ties to Riverside.
Is it possible he wrote the letters but didn't actually commit the crime? Like he just wanted to toy with investigators?
Absolutely. And the Zodiac responded. It took months, but on March 13th, 1971, he sent another letter, this one to the LA Times. It seemed to acknowledge the connection, saying in part, "I do have to give them credit for stumbling across my Riverside activity, but they're only finding the easy ones, and there's a hell of a lot more down there." Some people believe that Zodiac, who took months to respond, realized that he had slipped up and given the police insight to who he was, you know, someone with a connection to Riverside and Sherry Jo. Others believe that he was just toying with the police, something he relished doing. Or as you said, he could have been taking credit for something he did not do. Riverside police originally believed that the killers were the same person, but based on the similarity in the letters. But today they've turned away from their original belief that Zodiac was Sherry Jo's killer. And they now think that the two cases are unrelated. If they've somehow confirmed this through DNA testing, they've never confirmed this publicly. One final thing that happened was that in April 2016, someone wrote an anonymous letter to Riverside Police Department claiming responsibility for the three handwritten Bates had to die letters. The writer said that they were sent by him when he was a troubled teenager. In 2020, Riverside Police used DNA on the stamp to track down this person who confessed that the letters were a prank and that he had nothing to do with the Sherry Jo Bates murder. Always unfortunate when people
those letters were sent to the victim's family too, right?
That's correct. Think about all the time and the efforts that were spent investigating this false lead. So the Sherry Jo Bates case remains unsolved. Was she or wasn't she the earliest suspected Zodiac victim? Perhaps her murder was what gave him, you know, a taste for killing. We don't know. Perhaps his unrequited feelings and rage at her, you know, rejection of him, are what caused him to take out his anger on other couples. Perhaps he learned that stabbing is messy, dangerous, and sloppy. And so after this incident, he turned to guns. The matter has been fodder for speculation for decades, and people vehemently disagree. Riverside police do not believe that the Zodiac killed Sherry Jo, and they say that they have had a person of interest in their sights for the entire time, but need more information before an arrest can be made. Whether she was a Zodiac victim or not, Sherry Jo's case remains inextricably tied to the lore surrounding that infamous serial killer. Sherry Jo's father, Joseph, endowed a music scholarship in her name before he passed away, never knowing who had killed his beloved daughter. He died not having answers in his daughter's slaying. And whether Sherry Jo was killed by Zodiac or someone nobody knew who wanted vengeance against her for slighting him, in both cases, so far, he has gotten away with this crime. That's it on today's case for now, Amy, until such time when that vital DNA could, and we hope, will be linked to the true perpetrator of Sherry Jo's murder. I do believe, as we've said before, this case is highly solvable. Thank you for listening to this episode with us today, and we hope you'll join us next time on Campus Killings.
Campus Killings is hosted by Dr. Megan Sachs and Dr. Amy Schlossberg, with research and writing by Jessica Betancourt. It's produced by Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Be sure to follow Campus Killings on social media. You can find Campus Killings on Twitter with the handle @CampusKillings or on Facebook by searching for Campus Killings Podcast. Be sure to tune in every other Saturday for new episodes of Campus Killings.